Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the official Tennis.com podcast, featuring professional coach and community leader, Kamal Murray.
Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I'm your host, Kamal Murray. And this week, we have a pleasure of speaking to somebody that is a true inspiration and a hero back in his hometown of New Zealand. His name is Alex Hunt. He was a kid who's during his mother's pregnancy, the umbilical cord got wrapped around his left arm, which prevented his hand from fully developing. But that didn't let his dream of becoming a tennis player stop him at all. He went on to play college tennis, has ATP points, and has won matches on the ATP tour down in Guam. He's a true inspiration to us all, and I hope you enjoy it. But first, let's talk about what's unfolding down there in Melbourne. You've got Novak Djokovic going toe-to-toe with the Australian government, trying to fight for his ability to play this year's Australian Open. You've got the decision right now resting solely in the hands of the health minister. And let's think about the implications of that. We've got Novak, Rafa, Fed, all tied for 20. Novak gets this, he'll be in the lead. All the bonuses and all the money that comes with being the all-time Grand Slam holder, record holder. But if Novak is unable to play, and Rafa gets this one, you also have to assume Rafa is a lock for the French Open. And going into Wimbledon, where Roger's going to return, you've got Rafa. We could have Rafa with 22 Grand Slams and Novak with 20 and Fed with 20. And now Roger brought into the mix in Wimbledon. So a lot of historical implications here on the line for men's tennis that lie almost solely with the health minister in Australia. It's a lot of pressure to make that decision. Now let's talk about the women's side. We saw Ash Barty win in Adelaide. Will this year be an Ash Barty party? Will this be the first time in 44 years that an Australian woman can win the Australian Open? We've seen how when Aussies win this event, they are immortalized. They get stadiums named after them. Ken Rosewall, Rod Laver, Margaret Court. Is this Ash Barty's year? Can she handle the pressure? We see in other sports where there's a home court advantage. But in tennis, a lot of times that pressure associated with playing at home could be the home court disadvantage. Is she ready for that? Let's see. Enjoy my conversation with Alex Hunt. We'll see you next week. Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I'm your host, Kamal Murray, and today we have one of the most inspirational people in tennis, a person that was born with a disadvantage, but through that physical disadvantage, really got a mental edge over all the tennis players, and, you know, is an inspiration to everyone who knows his story, who knows him, everyone in that part of the world. We're here with the legend, Alex Hunt. Welcome to the show, bro.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Nice to meet you as well.
Yeah. So besides the U.S. Open, Australian Open is like my favorite. You know what I mean? Like that part of the region, there's so much American influence. Besides the time difference, which is a bitch. I mean, that is like rough. It feels like home. You know what I mean? You turn on the TV in a hotel. NBA games are still going on. Football games are still going on. Like you can kind of like live an American life. If you're up at 3 a.m., you know, the venue is like in a residential neighborhood where you could almost walk from the hotel or walk from, you know, some of the residential areas to it. And the way that you all promote your tennis players is a lot like how Americans promote their basketball players. And, you know, I miss it. Not in quarantine times, I don't miss it, but I miss it now. So tell me what it's like being from that region, right? Being from New Zealand. Tell me what the summer of tennis is like being from there.
Yeah, it's cool. It's cool for us, I guess, as well, because we get to follow along on the TV and everything. maybe we don't quite get the same atmosphere and the buzz, but we have our ASB tournament here when COVID isn't a thing. And that was always cool going up there as a kid or having Melbourne not too far away from New Zealand. So yeah, it's always a special time of the year and watching the summer unfold over there and kind of, I don't know, it's pretty cool.
Now, I feel like it's interesting you made the distinction between, you know, like Auckland and Melbourne, because I kind of view that, I still view that as you all slam, right? Yep. You still see people, everybody in the stands, some from New Zealand who came over for the week or for a couple of days. The flight is not that long. It's yep. interesting you made that distinction. You don't view that as like you all slam?
No, I think us Kiwis and Australians have quite a sporting sort of a conflict-y sort of love-hate relationship. So we like to keep our distance in most sporting aspects. But yeah, I guess it is kind of, and it's so easy for us to get there. We've got, as I said, our own little tournament here before COVID. I don't know. Hopefully we can keep it. Yeah. And that's our little bit of summer paradise, you know, going up there in the heat of summer, beautiful weather normally up in Auckland. And I guess that's our little piece. And then they carry on and go to the big boys league in Australia.
Well, let me ask you then. So where did you, you obviously were born with one arm shorter than the other, right? Yep. There it is, right? And managed to actually have a very successful tennis career, playing on the ATP tour, winning matches on the ATP tour. Where did you get your inspiration from? Was it a person? Is it like this part of the year where tennis is so big? Was it a parent? Where did it come from?
I think it's just, it probably started with, I was very lucky to be born into a family where they just accepted and loved me for who I was. And they didn't see my arm or my missing piece of an arm as a disability. They, as I said, growing up on a farm, I had two older brothers who both played tennis. Mum and dad played tennis. Grandma and grandpa across the road on the farm had a little tennis court and they played tennis. So I just got born into like a real positive, happy, didn't look at me any differently, sort of a family, you know? And I think also running around a farm, jumping on motorbikes and trying to drive a motorbike, driving me and my brother into a concrete wall fence and injuring us. And, you know, just growing up and having no fear sort of thing was awesome for me. And I'm so lucky and privileged to have that and my family. So I think that's probably what I got, as I said, lucky as a young person to grow up around that. And then it just carried on through into my tennis career. I played soccer, cricket, everything. But tennis was probably the thing that I really, really loved. And when I do little speaking things, I normally tell the kids the reason I chose tennis over soccer. Those were the two sports I really got into and played deep into my kind of teenage years. The reason I chose tennis instead of soccer was I literally couldn't wake up the next morning and think that I wasn't going to step on a tennis court in the next day or two. But I could see myself waking up and not playing soccer every day. So that was kind of the way I chose what I really wanted to do. I just couldn't see my life without it.
So did your parents teach you early on, or what was the first experience like when you stepped onto a tennis court with a coach that wasn't your parent? Was it like was the conversation full of limitation? Was it full of hope and possibility? You know, because as a coach, you know, we always look at kids. I look at kids and say, okay, they're short or they're tall or don't have great change of direction, great balance, right? You look at all these things that might limit them and you try to figure out, a good coach figures out a way to make up for them. And a bad coach is like, oh, okay, you'll probably play D3 tennis. So tell me about your entry into it.
Yeah, it's real interesting, eh? Because obviously my parents had viewed me as just a normal kid. I always wore a prosthetic arm. I got it here to show you guys. I've always grown up wearing these. I had some really tiny ones as a kid, obviously, like little pinches. And so I guess everyone I went to kind of saw me as normal because I had another arm, a prosthetic arm, and I just almost fit in. But my coaches, I got so lucky again, like I did with my family, never really thought it was something that would hold me back. My coach now has been with me since I was probably 14. or even younger than that. And we kind of talk about it sometimes, and he almost feels like he forgot that I had one arm, you know? And I'm lucky to have him still with me, mentoring me and just kind of being there for me in life, not just tennis. But yeah, it's been real interesting. And I look back on those years as, and I keep saying the same thing, but how lucky I was to be born into this family, meet these coaches, these people who could keep me positive and help me do what I love.
So you obviously got a one-hand backhand. I've seen it, and it's pretty wicked, actually. Now, when you chose a coach and when your parents were looking for coaches, were you looking for people who also hit the one-handed or sort of specialized in that?
Probably not as a young person. I wasn't. And I think, I don't think so. I was just so pumped to be on a tennis court. I was a young little fella. There's some video of me being a cheeky little bugger and kind of winning points in a tournament and just kind of having this evil laugh. This is when I was really young. And I think that just shows that when I was that age, I was just out there, not so much to win. I loved the winning when I was young, but I just love being on a tennis court, hitting balls. And I don't know, I guess it could be quite a safe place where I'm fitting in with other kids when I was young. And sport is a great thing for that, I think.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So as American male, right, I grew up and people say, okay, well, who did you look up to, you know, who inspired you to play tennis, right? Aside from your family, right?
Yeah.
And I would say that American males, especially Black males, have a hard time identifying like the one Black male or the one person, period. You know what I mean? I say Agassi was probably like the hippest, coolest dude on tour when I was coming up. So. Yeah. Besides your family, who was the Aussie? And like I said, the Aussies, you all have more depth on the men's side than we do on the men's side, right? And so you got Leighton. I mean, you have all kinds of people you could choose from who have like this swag and this charisma. You know, who inspired, who did you look up to, if anybody, you know, when you were
I really loved the two people you just mentioned. I really loved Leighton Hewitt's aggression and like his attitude towards the sport. Yeah, I used to watch all of his matches when I was young and just sitting right in front of the TV, not even on a chair, just on the carpet right in front of the TV, watching the Aussie Open and US Open, whatever it was. But I think someone that I really enjoyed, my favourite player when I was young, was Agassi. Partly because my family grew up calling me Aggie as my nickname, because my middle brother couldn't say Alex properly when I was young, so they were calling me Aggie, and it kind of just went with Agassi, but I had all his clothes and his pajama shorts and stuff like that. I just loved watching him play, and I don't know, his skill, his fight, his determination, and just the way he could return the ball, I guess. He was a beast, man.
So you talk about how when you were a kid, you had a prosthetic limb.
Yeah.
Now when you play, right, and a full-grown adult and probably can maneuver it probably better than you did as a kid, you don't play with one. Why is that? How do you make the decision to not use one? Particularly, you think about tossing the ball or maybe stabilizing the one-hand backhand. It seemed like it would be something you'd think about now.
Yeah, it was really weird. As I said, we grew up, me and my coaches, using my prosthetic, and it was always just this awesome thing that helped me do everything. I could tie shoelaces. I could do anything, drive a car. And we never actually thought, obviously I didn't, because it was such a great thing and helped me do everything. We never thought that maybe without the arm I'd have more freedom, or you know what I mean? So I was playing futures tournaments over in Thailand, me and my friend over there, and I fell over on the court one day and I just couldn't wear my prosthetic the next day because there was a big lump on here. So we were like, screw it. I'm going to keep training. I just won't be able to serve, obviously. And So I went out and started hitting, and I was like, holy shit, like unbelievable the difference of having sort of that freedom to just release the arm and open up properly. Yeah. Whereas when I had the arm on, I didn't feel, because it wasn't part of me, it was just this extra thing. Right. I didn't feel like I could get past probably there.
Yeah.
Because it would just almost feel like it was going to pop off.
Right.
So I went out there and started hitting, and I was like, shit, man, this is unbelievable. But what am I going to do? Like, I can't play without my arm because I won't be able to serve. So the next tournament, I trained like that for a couple of weeks. And when I was serving, I'd take my, chuck my arm on. And when I was returning, I'd throw my arm to the back of the court. So I'd say a lot of players hadn't seen someone throw their arm to the back of the court during a match. So I went to Taipei, and I actually did that for two tournaments there, and I played really well. But obviously, as you can imagine, serving a service game with it, I didn't feel great on the ground strokes, and it was just really odd. And then I was changing for the return games, and I felt amazing. So it wasn't, obviously it wasn't ideal changing game after game.
Right.
But it was awesome. I played well, and I was really nervous because probably for the first time I felt a little bit naked on the tennis court without this, playing a match. It was fine in training, but when I turned up and there was people watching and kind of the nerves and the stress of playing a match, I felt quite nervous to be out there. And luckily my friend was awesome, and he sat there and gave me someone to kind of look at after points and, you know, take my mind off what I was probably worrying about. Mm-hmm. But then that was all good. That's kind of how I had committed to playing from then on. And then I got back to New Zealand, and probably a week before nationals here, our national kind of tournament, this time I was training without my arm on, just hitting, and I charged up for a drop shot, and I flipped over, landed right on my stump, and again it puffed up, so I couldn't serve with it. And my thought was I won't be able to play nationals. And then a day or so later, I was out on court training, and we got done with all the training stuff, and my friends were like, okay, we're going to play points. And I was like, sweet, I'll jump on the umpire chair and give you guys some shit where you play and, you know, just have a bit of fun. And they're like, nah, bro, come on, just like put the ball in your stump and see if you can throw it up and hit a serve. Right. And I was like, oh, are you sure? And I don't want to ruin their training, you know? And they're like, yeah, do it. And sure enough, I went out there, put the ball in that little kind of gap between the elbow and the stump, and popped it up. And it wasn't pretty for the first wee while, but I was getting every serve in, just kind of gently slicing them in and stuff. And it kind of just got us thinking that maybe I don't need my prosthetic arm. And then probably for the next 5 days before the tournament, I went out twice a day with a box of balls and worked on the serve every day. And the guy I was staying with is classic Kiwi guy. And he got a wristband, and he cut a hole in it, so the ball had somewhere to kind of grip. Because that was the one thing I struggled with, was a brand new Wilson tennis ball is a little bit slippery on the skin. So it was just not quite sitting in that kind of that gap properly. So yeah, I played that tournament a wee while later and probably served as good or better than I ever have, especially in doubles. I think I struggled in the singles a little bit because it was such a new thing for me and people were watching, and I think I let that get the better of me. But I just needed that first tournament to get it out of the way, and now it's just feels so natural, and finally feels like on the service I can feel the ball going off my hand instead of off the plastic. You're not with the ball, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's been crazy. It was all weird how it happened, but I guess it was supposed to be.
Well, you know, as a coach, I'm thinking about it, and one of the things that I find on a toss is I find people's fingers cover the ball.
Yeah.
And send the ball back behind them.
Almost like gripping it.
Yeah, gripping the ball, right? So the fingers send the ball back that way, and you end up tossing the ball behind them.
Yeah.
And I also find that they sort of bend their elbow prematurely, right? And it makes it even harder to toss. And I'm looking at, you know, your arm, and I'm like, that could actually probably give a nice projected ball with no spin. Because you also see people who toss a ball and it's spinning, right, as it's in the air. Right. And you never want to like kind of like toss yourself a curveball or a ball that's spinning. You want the ball to like, you know, just naturally flow up there and sort of like hang in the air with no spin. And I would imagine that the ball doesn't come off your arm and spin at all.
Mm.
If that,
yeah, it's interesting. We my coach,
you
gotta
serve with the hand, so you wouldn't know the difference. But as a, like with like a hand and a palm, yeah, you know, if you're not really like focused on the release, the ball will spin when it leaves your hand.
Yeah, it'll kind of roll off your fingers, eh?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, it's funny. Me and my coach are still good friends. And as I say, I've been coaching for the last year or so and really enjoying it. And we kind of joke a little bit between us. He mentors me a little bit. And we kind of joke and say if we can't get someone to serve right, we just threaten to cut their arm off so they'll have a serve like me, you know. That's probably a bad thing to say to a 10-year-old, but
I know. Oh, man. But, you know, so you touched on something earlier about how, you know, you're playing a tennis match and most people are really insecure about them looking at them, right? So you see a lot of kids who don't want their parents to come in and watch them play, don't invite our relatives, right? Or even, you know, even at the pros, right? And they sort of have that one person, a coach or somebody on their team that they sort of lock in on to ignore the 19,000 other people that are watching, right? And unfortunately, there's no place for anyone to hide on the tennis court, right? Yeah. When you're down 6-0, 5-0, you wish you can crawl up under that bench, right? And hide, and you can't. So tell me about how you develop like the strength, because when people come on the side of the court, yes, they're coming to watch a tennis match, but they're also watching you to see how you do what you do, right? Tell me about how you overcame that insecurity.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. It's still something that obviously I haven't perfected, otherwise I'd probably have a better ranking and be better than I am. But it's probably something that I grew up with, people looking at me and wondering what's wrong with his arm, mum, or what, why has he got that, mum? Which was actually really good for me. And I love it nowadays and all through my life. I love it when someone comes up and asks me about it. Because I don't want them to feel like what happened there. I'd like to help the little kid understand, or I know some people might not be like that and it's maybe looked upon as rude, but I'm someone who wants to welcome that, you know? Mm. And as a kid, before every school year, me and my mum or me and my dad would go into the class and I'd stand up front with my arm and show them all how it worked. And we'd just kind of explain to them why I am like I am. And I think from a young age for me and for the kids that were all at my school, it helped me feel like everyone knew what had happened to me, or why I was like I was. And it just set things on a good start at school, you know. Mm. And for me to get out there as a young kid like that, my parents to help me do that, I think that helped me through my sporting career. It wasn't, my arm wasn't something I worried about. I still think when I'm on the court, maybe I worry about outside noise too much, but it's something I can use as well to fire me up. And I love playing in front of a little bit of a crowd. And especially, you know, if you get into the match and you feel like you're part of it, it's probably obviously different when you're down 6-love, 5-love, because you don't feel like you're in the match. But when you get into it and you're in the third set and you're sweating and you're playing the match and you're in the zone, it's just, it's awesome. And you're not worried about anything on the outside. You're just there to play and win and do what you love. So I don't know. I think as a young kid, the arm helped me with that in some way, but it's all interesting for a tennis player.
No, I mean, cause you know, I'll be honest with you. So when I use the word like insecure, you know, not to say that you are insecure, but like as a kid, when I grew up, you know, all the tennis tournaments were in white tennis clubs. Right. Yep. And I was always the only black kid showing up at the tennis tournament. Right. And my parents never came in to watch. So my dad would pull up to the tennis club. He'd sit in the car. He's a lawyer. He'd sit in the car and like go through his documents and file. I remember that yellow legal paper, like a legal pad. He'd sit there and do his work. And I'd go in, check in myself, play the match myself. And I'd always feel really insecure. A, being in there, being the only black dude in there. Right. And everyone's sort of looking at you like, you got some sort of disadvantage, right? You know what I'm saying? And it's like that. So I think that experience early on, like you just touched on, like created like this level of like, you know, almost armor, right? And you're used to people kind of looking at it. So now you walk into a room, you think about all those times from 7 to 17 where you were uncomfortable and you walk into the room like really confident. And Bill just said, is that something you preach to the kids? Because that's the number one lesson when I'm on the court with a kid is I look at, you know, yeah, you're going to be a great tennis player, be a great athlete, be in shape, hopefully get a college scholarship. But as a person, if you can survive on this tennis court by yourself, with everybody looking at you, then you're just going to be a much better person later on. Is that a message that you deliver?
Yeah, that's awesome. I try to deliver things like that. I'm probably not as good as you at those sort of things, but I think it is pretty cool. I've learned so much in this year coaching. I think I've grown up a lot. I'm already 28, but I think I've really kind of learned how you can push these kids to the next level, and that the fact that I have one arm and I'm out there coaching and kind of sharing little stories like you've just done with me can help them grow so much and feel the confidence that they can do it on their own and they don't need their mum or their dad to look at, or to, if they miss a couple of shots, it's not their mum's fault or their racket's fault. You know, it's just time to dig down and go for the next point and be positive. But yeah, it's awesome. I've been going to a sports psychologist this year just to try and learn and up myself. And it's all things that I can pass on to the kids I coach. And some of the stuff I've taken from there and handed to the kids has, number one, taught me more probably. And like you say, it can create an arm around the kids for when they go and play at tournaments and they're worried about what this kid thinks of their forehand or their backhand or this, you know? Mm. I think in New Zealand, there's a bit of this, like, got to try and look cool on the court. And I think, honestly, when I went to Germany to play club tennis, that's where I learned that being cool on the court is not a thing, you know? Like, some of the techniques and things I saw over there was just so inspiring for me, because I was watching these players that I thought, no disrespect to anyone, because my technique's not good. Not good. But, like, I was seeing people go out with, like, a technique that I thought was like a club player, and they were demolishing players that I thought were like awesome looking technique and stuff. And that's where I finally learned, like, it's not about how you've, you know, technique's important, but it's about this thing inside you that you want to dig in and win and find a way, you know?
Yeah. People don't know club tennis in Germany and France is big. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I think we've tried, you know, world team tennis in America, but like club tennis over there, it's like, I mean, you got, you know, Tatiana Maria playing. You have like actual pros playing on these club teams. And, you know, it's a trip. So you're obviously wearing a Wilson shirt, right? And I feel like over the years, people with one hand backhands have gotten a bigger disadvantage, right? Because now we're playing with extra duty balls, right? And they're heavier, right? And the courts are getting bouncier, right? There's more acrylic on the court. Do you feel like, as you, now that you're on tour, right, and you're trying to make it, the game is sort of getting away from you because now you got the one hand, right, and now the balls are like bouncing higher, heavier, right? People are stringed, everybody hitting the ball bigger. It's like, come on now, slow down. Let me get in the game first.
No, actually, to be honest, I'm just so happy that I've grown up and gotten stronger, because as a young fella, I was battling, man. Like, these guys were all hitting two-handers and like feeling so strong, and I'm out here as a little kid with like little plank arms, right, trying to hit I was trying to hit these balls and couldn't do it, so I ended up slicing a lot and just running around and crushing forehands as a young fella. But I'm just so happy that I feel strong enough to hit over it, and that my backhand's probably one of the things that have improved the most in the last 5 years. Because even out of college, I went to play college tennis, even out of college I didn't feel like I'd fully matured and I was able to stand and rip with these guys, you know. I think I was quite late in that aspect to finally grow into my body and feel strong enough to stay out there and hit and be a part of a match with these guys. But yeah, I fully agree, like, the balls are, some of the courts are kicking up over your head, and the rackets, the people, everyone's training harder and harder as they see the limits that their body can go. Like, I mean, probably in 20 years, there'll be probably 3 or 4 Djokovic's, you know? everyone's sort of seeing the limits and the new limits and the new, it's cool, but it's crazy.
But you mentioned the style, right? So you, like, you know, chipping backhands, looking for forehands. I mean, there's dudes with two arms that play that way, right? You look at like Jack Sock, right? He's like chipping and looking for forehand. Chris Eubanks, they just chipping and looking for forehand. There's guys that actually make a living on tour playing that way.
Yeah.
So you're really not that disadvantaged if you're clear. And I think that's why what your story is so inspiring, because when I first read about you years ago, I was like, oh, piece of cake. If he can get the toss right, he can just chip and look beforehand, right? And it's like, as a coach, when you see a kid at 8, 9, 10 years old, you look at him and say, okay, how can we maximize their opportunity in this game?
Yeah.
Right? And not focus on what they can't do, right? And so 2 years ago, I was like, oh, yeah, chip and look beforehand. If he can move, right? If he can backpedal, right? If he can get around the ball and play the left side of the court, he's good.
Yeah.
So you obviously had a college coach that saw that and believed in your opportunity, believed in your talent, right, and your ability. So tell us about like that moment, because it's one thing to believe in yourself, it's one thing for your parents to believe you, but to get a college coach who gets paid to win, right, to believe in you, that had to be a, you know, like a, an inspiring moment. So tell us a little bit about that whole experience and about that person.
Yeah, it was. I was talking about this just the other day because I look back sometimes and wonder if the coach was crazy or, you know, what happened to him to kind of take that chance on me. And I got quite lucky. I had a coach here, Lan Bale, who knew of some coaches over in America, and he kind of got me talking to a few. And there was one spot that I really liked, St. Mary's College in California. Decent basketball team.
And
it all kind of happened, but had a few video calls with the coach, and he obviously saw a bit of video from me and probably had spoken to a coach over here. But just the fact that he had the confidence in me or wanted to take the chance on me to kind of let me play out or have a crack at my dream and go over there and do what I love is something that for the rest of my life I'll be grateful for. And it's just in the moment, because I was kind of looking at myself as a normal person, you know, I didn't quite respect how big it was from him to take on a kid with a disability. But looking back, it's just, I can't believe it. And I never actually spoke to him about it. The fact that he took on that, but he did tell me a little story when I got there. He had kind of spoken to a few of the teammates that they had on the team at that stage and said to them, what do they think? And from watching me play, they're all like, yeah. And he's like, am I just doing this to be a good person, or is this kid's good, isn't he? And so it was cool to hear that they got me on board because of the way I could play as well.
They probably were like, yeah, he reminds me of Steve Johnson. California boys, right? You're in California. Like, oh, yeah, that's just a New Zealander, you know, Steve Johnson, right?
Yeah. I mean, and the other little thing is that the guys we were talking about chipping backhands, one of my favorite players as a young fella was Gonzalez. Like, unbelievable, man.
Nasty.
Just all he did was just crush forehands. Right. So that was another guy that I really looked up to as a young fellow, because I knew I had a forehand at that stage and not much else. And that's kind of how I wanted to play.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So before I let you go, I got to ask you, you know, obviously there's a lot of talk right now about Novak and the whole, you know, visa situation. You know, last year I went to Australia, didn't plan on having a quarantine for 2 weeks, landed in Australia and boom, escorted to the government run hotel. For you, that region has done so well with COVID, right? You know, like barely any cases, strict government quarantines, lots of vaccinations. How do you all feel about sort of the players, and it's not just Novak, right, but players coming in being exempt for the rules?
Yeah, I honestly, I'm not sure what to think of it. I think at first I was a little bit unsure. And then as kind of, I would say, bad things started to happen to him and rough things, and it sounds like it's happened to a lot of players, I started to feel bad for the situation and like he was being dealt with in a bad way. But it's honestly, I can't really have a say on it because it's the Australian kind of government have put up with a lot of COVID, and they've had some massive lockdowns as we have had in New Zealand. So it's a tough thing to comment on, but yeah, some players have been put in some tough positions and maybe they could have had some better talkings with Australia and the border and the tournament managers and things. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. It's tough for everyone involved, I think. I don't know.
It definitely will have a big impact on history, right? Because I try to like forward think. So let's just play this scenario. Novak doesn't play. And Rafa, you know, becomes a favorite.
Yeah.
He wins this one, gets 21, breaks the record first. Rafa almost is a lock to win the French Open. That puts him at 22-20.
Yeah.
Right? Fed comes back at Wimbledon, right? And that puts really the last slam of the year, maybe that, you know, Novak has the advantage there at the U.S. Open. So I feel like that decision, right, or this sort of moment is shaping tennis history on the men's side. Because if Novak doesn't play, you almost have Rafa with 22-20.
Yeah.
You know, and no one would bet against Rafa at the French Open, right? So you give him the next two. And now he's got a good little, it'll be a year before anybody else catches him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So in my mind, I was calculating. I was like, ooh, this is like lots of bonuses on the line. This is lots of history, lots of dollars, right, on the line when you think about these types of situations. And you wonder if the conversations behind closed doors are like, hey, guys, you understand you probably – playing with $100 million and bonus and records and this and that, you know what I mean?
It's crazy. Yeah. It's it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But are these other guys like Medvedev and Zverev and stuff gonna give Rafa some big problems on the hard court, or do you reckon Rafa's got it under the belt if Djokovic doesn't play?
You know what? I think at this slam with the rebound ace courts, right, that they play with in Melbourne, I think Rafa's ball is going to kick up to a level similar to it does at the French Open. Yeah. And aside from Djokovic, I think there's no one that could beat him just on this surface. I think, you know, Medvedev and Zverev for sure could beat him. I don't know if they could beat him with the high bounce on this surface, right? So, you know. Who knows what happens, right? And then even with Djokovic sort of maybe getting a late start to his preparation, you still, he's got an excuse in his back pocket to use if he doesn't win it, right? But I mean, having not won nine of them, if he plays, you know, you got to sort of assume that he'll, you know, sort of make it to the finish line. And every player in the locker room knows that, like, man, this dude's won nine of these, right? Yeah. So I just sort of was like, up at night thinking like, wow, you know, if this doesn't go Novak's way, this could be 22-20 Rafa by the end of June.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And how 6 months, this decision impacts tennis for the next, you know, year per se. But it's going to be interesting.
Yep. It's gonna be interesting. And then Rog got to come back and win Wimby. Has to.
I mean, look, you know, the story could be Novak gets this one, Rafa gets the French, and then Fed gets Wimbledon, and they back tied at 21. And then the U.S. Open becomes like some big, you know. Yeah. So, you know, so we just wrote like three articles for the tennis writers right now. Right? Scenario A, scenario B.
Look at us go.
Right. Well, man, I wanted to thank you for spending the time with me today. Like I said, when I, you know, read about your story 2 years ago, you know, I was inspired by it. I immediately thought of like Stevie Johnson, you know what I mean? All kind of guys who have made a good living on tour, had a lot of success that, you know, I was like, oh yeah, he could just play this way, right? And sort of hide it. So, you know, I appreciate you spending time with us. You know, good luck in your career. I know you're just getting started. I know COVID kind of put a monkey wrench in your, in sort of your momentum, but, you know, keep going, brother. That's all I got to say.
Legend, man. Appreciate it. And it's been fun getting to know you and having a chat. Hopefully keep in touch and
yeah.
Champion, thanks for the chat.
All right, well, this has been a Tennis.com podcast. I'm your host, Kamal Murray, and we just had the pleasure of chopping it up with Alex Hunt. We'll see you next time.